welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Finian Cunningham. Last time Finian was on, he was in Dakar, Africa, dare I say. Well, he was in Eastern Africa, Northeastern Africa, and now he's back home in Northern Ireland for a while before he heads off on the road again. He's a traveling man. My working lifetime when I did so much, that's in the past, and travel I don't do very much of now, thankfully, especially with all the hassle at the airports. But Finian is a musician, he's a writer, he's an activist, and when he's not traveling, he's based in Northern Ireland. Other times, he is off somewhere doing research. We're going to talk about research that he's done and writing that he is in the process of doing on Bahrain. We'll compare it to what's going on in Syria. I put out a new article on Bahrain this morning myself. I've written a fair number on it, but I've never been there, and Finian has. He's seen firsthand, and nothing substitutes for that when you really want to cover an issue, and he's seen it with his own eyes. Finian, I welcome you to the program, and you've been back a couple of days. I hope you're getting reacclimated and rested.
Stephen, it's a pleasure as always to be talking with you and to be sharing thoughts and ideas and sharing it with your listeners. And yeah, I want to say your listeners are very lucky to have a man such as yourself with all your knowledge and experience and insights and prolific writing and your commitment to human rights and democracy. Stephen, it's a pleasure to be on your show, and thank you very much for having me.
Your comments really I'm very grateful for. You are heroic for me. You literally get in the line of fire. I've never done that. The closest I came to it was when NATO invaded Chicago.
I hope I'm not overindulging.
Not at all.
But I mean, I find, Stephen, like your writing is just so dependable, and when you make a judgment or a call on a certain matter, whether it be Syria or Libya or Israel and Palestine or Bahrain, I mean, you're just a rock of reliability, and your commitment to the truth and to justice is impeccable. And I just always feel confident that if I want to check on something, I'll read Stephen Lenman.
Oh, again, Finian, you're awfully kind. I read all your articles that are posted on Global Research. And again, I must say, I marvel that you're getting right and seeing things firsthand. And maybe when I was younger, travel was something I always looked forward to. In my later years, and I don't know how tough it is going through the security in Northern Ireland to go somewhere, let alone the various countries that you visit, let alone when you get on the firing line in a place like Bahrain. But I do know that going through O'Hare Airport in Chicago is not something I relish doing, especially when I worry that maybe somebody's gotten familiar with my name, and they will flag me down when I get there, and maybe they'll let me go, but put me through the third degree, strip searches, whatever, tie me down for a few hours, and make me miss my flight. Mm-hmm. Who wants to go through that kind of stuff? But that's the state of conditions in America today.
I know travel is such a hassle. Like, it really is the way that, just this continual, it's degrading, taking off your shoes, taking off your belts, and all for what? It's just this whole war on terror is in my view, and I'm sure, I think you share too, Stephen, it's just a charade and a complete concoction to justify all sorts of foreign policy transgressions. But When you mentioned about me travelling to putting myself in the line of fire, Stephen, in Bahrain, to be honest, really, I just happened to be there. I mean, I was working in Bahrain as a business journalist, and for about, it was actually 4 years ago this month. It was June the 8th. I started June 8th, 2008. I started working as a production editor on a business magazine based in Bahrain, and like, I was oblivious to Bahrain and the Persian Gulf Arab states. I mean, I didn't really know much about them. Well, I knew they were autocratic monarchies, and but apart from that, I didn't really know much else. And when in Bahrain, I was living a bit of a charmed life, working as a typical white expat, really cocooned from the realities of Bahraini society. Now, when I actually finished my contract after 2 years in 2010, June 2010, and the economies were going very badly in that part of the world, from the magazine I was working on in particular, they were reducing staff, cutting staff, and letting people go. And then I actually completed my 2-year contract, but they didn't renew it. So I was just in Bahrain trying to get a job, trying to get any sort of job anywhere in the world. And rather than coming back to Ireland, which was in a really economic mess, I just decided to stay on in Bahrain, living off a bit of savings that I'd saved over the previous 2 years. And then, lo and behold, the whole Arab Spring took off in Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, and it was like watching a hurricane or satellite imagery of a hurricane or something. You could see the forces of change spreading right across the region, and I just had an eerie feeling that weeks before it actually have sparked off in Bahrain, that it was going to just do that. And so when it did, I just happened to be a journalist was out of work, and lo and behold, a story landed on my lap, and that's how it came about. I didn't anticipate, I didn't travel to Bahrain specifically to cover the momentous and which are going on ongoing, the turmoil. It just so happened I was there. And I think a good journalist is like a good doctor or a nurse. If you see a scene of a problem, violence, you have to go and you have to just immerse yourself in that scene, try to get to the truth of what's going on. And it's just an ethical principle that a journalist should do, rather than hiding away from the situation or indeed giving a very negative spin that would be supportive of the government, the perpetrators of violence. You make a call, you try to get it on side to find out what's going on, who's perpetrating what, who's suffering, and you report on it as it is. And because of that, then I got in trouble with the Bahraini regime. They deported me then June last year. So that's my little take on Bahrain so far.
Well, you're lucky, Finian, they didn't do something more than just ask you to leave the country.
Well, they could have done something nastier indeed, Stephen. So I suppose I was lucky to get out of it. And I still keep in touch with Bahrain. I've got plenty of good contacts there, and very much following the news. And I saw your piece there, Stephen. Was it today about the human rights lawyer, Mohammed Al-Tayyar, being targeted now for his testimony in the United Nations Universal Periodic Review of Bahrain's human rights records. I think he testified in Geneva, and then since we're coming back to Bahrain, as with other people who testified to that UN committee or panel, they've been targeted by the regime. And you wrote about that this morning, was it, Stephen, or yesterday?
The one on Al-Tayyar, the Bahraini human rights lawyer, I put that out this morning.
Yeah.
And I've written so many articles on Syria, Finian. I mean, lately it seems like they're going out every single day, and I'll have another one for tomorrow. And, the only thing we have, the only weapon we have, our pen, so to speak, and our voice. And we don't have the megaphone of the major media that do absolutely scandalous work, where they literally get on the pro-war bandwagon and they support the idea of imperial wars with really no thoughts whatsoever of the absolute devastation and the massive loss of human life and the incredible human suffering. This just passes right under their radar. They don't give it a thought. Washington wants to go to war, they're right there supporting it. They don't pay any attention to the fact attacks. They just backed up. Yeah. But I'm old enough to remember some of the World War II propaganda, but there was no television then.
Yeah,
no radio.
Yeah.
And
really, Stephen, can you remember the World War II propaganda?
Very slightly. Very, very slightly. My dad would listen to certain radio programs in the evening, and some of the comments that I picked up, more or less inadvertently, because I was very young, and I didn't really care about listening to Gabriel Heater. And
yeah.
Oh, I forget some of the ones he listened to, but he listened to various radio programs with commentaries and so on. I remember Gabriel Heater. I remember Drew Pearson, this muckraking journalist. I remember Walter Winchell, who was more of a Broadway beat kind of a journalist, who hung out in nightclubs and places like that. Celebrity interview style was what he did. But I think he dipped into maybe a number of things. I remember these guys, and I would just pick up comments here or there. I guess they were the latter-day examples of the kind of people who show up on TV today. But now we've got the images along with the chatter. But I was very young. I was about, 6 or 7 years old when World War II began. Too young to really remember Pearl Harbor. Afterwards, that I realized what happened. And a good number of my family members were in the war. My uncles were in the war. And my dad was in World War I. They all came back safe and sound. Thankfully, my dad did, or you and I wouldn't be on the phone right now.
Yeah, well, true. But and do you think the mainstream media, so-called news service, has become more propagandistic, more unrestrained in its more unalloyed in its propaganda? I mean, you know, I just wonder, you know, how do you find it's drifted over the decades? Stephen, what do you think?
Oh, it's much worse today than it ever was before. I mean, I can remember in the age of television during the Vietnam War where you would get some reasonably credible reports from people like Walter Cronkite.
Mm-hmm.
And Walter Cronkite was the one, he was the key television journalist of his time, anchor on CBS. And Lyndon Johnson accused him of losing the Vietnam War. He turned against the war. And
those
were the days before the Pentagon would sanitize the footage. And there were videos on TV every night of the fighting going on in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. I honestly can't remember any specific ones. It was so long ago. But he aired this, the kind of stuff that never gets on TV today. Mm-hmm. And he aired it. And some of his commentaries, they weren't the kind of stuff you'll hear on this program and others like it, but compared to what goes on TV today especially, it was a breath of fresh air. And I actually, after he retired, I contacted his office. He maintained an office at CBS. He was, I think, in his early 90s by then, and it was a few years ago before he died, and I contacted his office and spoke to someone in it. I tried to get him on my program. I wanted to get him on my program, and they told me that he had reached the age where he just didn't want to do any more of that. He just wanted to spend out his remaining time sailing. He liked to sail, and I can appreciate that. He was very old. The burden of being asked one person after another, please come on my program and give an interview. He didn't want to do that anymore. He spent his whole life doing it. So I understood that and respected it. But it would have been wonderful to have a conversation with him.
Yeah,
now he's gone.
Definitely.
Now
it would be interesting to hear his kind of perspective on the way the mainstream media has changed over the years, and their way of coverage, reportage on various issues. I mean, you know, Libya, disgraceful in my view, I think yours too, Stephen. Syria again, I mean, it's just an agenda news, so-called news service. You know, it's a politicized agenda, and you know, like setting the stage for to facilitate Western government foreign policy, particularly Washington and London, to, well, regime change in Syria, as they did in Libya and with Iran. And it's so audaciously agenda driven. It's really just, you know, the information wing of the Pentagon, or, you know, MI6 or you know, the Western government military, you know, industrial complexes. And, you know, and this is where what really annoys me intensely about Bahrain, with regard to Bahrain. I mean, Bahrain, the absolute numbers may appear small compared with Syria or Libya, but I mean, the proportionate to the population, it's a very small island. It's only got like about 600,000 indigenous Bahraini inhabitants. So per capita, the casualty figures are way beyond what you might have seen in Egypt or Tunisia or even Syria. And yet the Western media say absolutely, well, relatively speaking, very little. There's a dearth of coverage on what's going on in Bahrain, these horrible transgressions and violations of human rights, indeed crimes against humanity, you know, overtaking hospitals, abusing, torturing doctors and nurses, gassing elderly people in their homes and babies too. And, you know, the Western media does not have any passion or, you know, anger or indignation about that. It's all, you know, focused on Syria. Why? Because the Western governments want regime change in Syria, whereas in Bahrain, it's an ally of the West for their oil supplies and what have you, with the Saudi monarchy in tow there. And so how self-serving and cynical and selective is that? I mean, and so I think Bahrain, that's why I'm quite very passionate about Bahrain, because I would like to tell people more about it, and you do too, Stephen, but because it illustrates the double standard and the complete cynicism of Western governments, you know, their so-called commitment to human rights and democracy that they pontificate towards the Assad government in Syria or previously in Libya. I mean, where are those principles when it comes to Bahrain? They go absolutely, you know, they're struck mute on Bahrain, and they say nothing, or, you know, really of any, you know, severity, you know, any of any substance to the Bahraini regime and the Saudi backers, even though there's crimes being committed daily in Bahrain that are would equally compare with what's allegedly happening in Syria.
Oh, there's no question about it, Finney, and especially U.S. television. I don't watch the major media television, but I'm very aware of what they do and what they don't do. And I think there's a virtual blackout on what's going on in Bahrain, but you sure get the hot and heated anti-Assad rhetoric about Syria, and talk about a hypocritical double standard. There's no question about it. I'm also obsessed with Bahrain, because of the terrible abuses that this terrible despotic monarchy, the Al Khalifa monarchy, I mean this outrageous despotic regime, and they go at the Bahraini people, and yet I have a passion for these people, who of course I don't know, I've never been there, but virtually every day, Stephen, they're
wonderful people. I mean, the Bahraini character is just a wonderful, delightful, kind-hearted, open spirit. Their people is very moving. You know, and I got, thankfully, to go back to the start of our conversation, I came out of my expat cocoon bubble existence when I became unemployed and I was looking for work, and then the uprising took place, and then I actually started to meet the Bahraini people, go to the villages. They would brought me into their houses, they'd shared whatever they had in their house, you know, a little bit of tea or food, and their spirit, and thankfully I got to experience the real Bahraini heart, not the regime, the officialdom, you know, the regime slice of the society, but the real, you know, the real heart of Bahrain. And they're just absolutely wonderful people. Really, their commitment to democracy is just awesome and very peaceful. You know, look at all the violence that's been heaped on them by the Al Khalifa regime, with the Saudi troops and the troops from Qatar and the Saudi Arab Emirates, with London and Washington's blessing. And yet these people just retain a very deep commitment to democracy, democratic rights, and peaceful protests. Their spirit is just awesome. It's amazing. And Stephen, I just know, sorry to cut in on you, you were about to say something, but I just know that if you were you'd be in your element. You'd be just loving it, you know, the reception you'd get from the people.
Oh, absolutely. The point I wanted to make, Finian, was that despite all the harshness that the regime throws at them, the people of Bahrain are on the streets non-violently protesting virtually every single day. They're being brutalized. Some of them are being killed. They're being put in prison. They're being tortured. If a doctor or a nurse or other medical professional treats an injured person who has protested, they're arrested. They're put in prison. They're tortured. They're put on trial. Yes. They're convicted. They're in prison. Who ever heard of a country that prosecutes a doctor for treating an injured person? The doctor has nothing to do with what's going on in the streets or anything else. The doctor is doing his or her job. And yet a lot of them have been persecuted. It's outrageous stuff.
Yeah. I mean, Stephen, like I was in Somania Public Hospital. It's the big public hospital in Bahrain, in the capital, Manama. And I was there during the first 4 weeks. Well, I was there, you know, for months, but I remember very clearly the first 4 weeks when the Arab Spring began in Bahrain, and it was the 14th of February, Valentine's Day, and there was 4 weeks after that, the people really, if you like, almost took over the kingdom with their sheer numbers, and they mounted the fantastic permanent peace camp, protest camp in Manama, right in the financial district, the financial harbour area. And it was like an absolutely amazing defiance of the regime. I mean, bear in mind, these Arab countries, you're not allowed even to congregate in the street with more than maybe, I don't know, 10 or 20 numbers. It's not allowed. It's illegal. It's banned. You know, whatever that purpose might be, it might be just to have a public meeting, but you're not allowed. That's banned. So you have people, you know, defying the laws, the work laws of the kingdom, by being out with maybe 300,000 people. That's nearly half the population at these demonstrations that were centered around the Pearl Monument, which subsequently was destroyed by the regime. But their bravery and their defiance was just breathtaking, and it was exhilarating, you know, being there. And sorry, I'm kind of digressing a bit, but during that time, the regime forces would fire on people, and you know, with very indiscriminate fire of you know, tear gas and shotguns and sound grenades and things like that. And then the violence really ramped up when the Saudis then came in on the 15th of March, about approximately a month after the beginning of the Bahraini Arab Spring. The Saudis came in with the Emiratis and I think the Qataris too, in tanks and armoured personnel carrier, and they literally just, you know, just cracked down, you know, hammered down on the people, peaceful, unarmed civilians. These armed troops, you know, fired on the people and you know, crushed what was a peaceful demonstration. And anyway, the people were brought into the hospitals. It was pandemonium. People were being brought in on, you know, like trolleys flying down the corridor. The doctors were and nurses were really overstretched, trying to cope with all these casualties that were coming in over the weeks, and especially when the Saudis came in. And it was very, very disturbing. I mean, these doctors and nurses were at times really overcome emotionally with the horrible wounds that they were trying to attend to. And, you know, were people, like young guys with eyes missing because they were shot deliberately by the regime forces to, in the eye, at the, in the head. And I think it was a sort of a sick, sinister symbolism there, was to take away your eye so you could not be a witness to what was happening, what the protest of against the regime. And because there was a lot of kids with, you know, eyes were destroyed, they lost their eyes. And I remember a doctor saying to me that it's very, very strange, all these young men seem to have this, you know, this similar injury, you know, like a loss of eye. So there was many, many horrible injuries, and the doctors were just flat out. I mean, they were trying to cope in this kind of, like, it was like a war, you know, hospital. Really, it was like a war field hospital in a war zone. And then, as you said, Stephen, there, you know, before I began into this part of the conversation, exactly that's what happened when the Saudis then cracked down, the Saudi-led forces cracked down on the protest movement. The first place that they went to after they cleared the public gathering at the Pearl Monument, the next place that they went to was the hospital, and they scooped up all the patients, all the doctors and all the nurses, and because the doctors and the nurses were your prime witnesses to these atrocities, and they very, very deliberately, commandeered the hospital and the staff in the hospital to shut them up so that the world would not know about the crimes that they were committing, you know. So, and I saw this, I saw the way that the patients were pulled out of their beds and they were made to file out the door, the main door of the hospital, and they were checked off by the Interior Ministry, and put into buses. And the other doors in the hospital, they were all blocked by armed soldiers. This was a crime against humanity that Washington and London, turn a blind eye to, say nothing about, but yet when they're subverting and orchestrating violence in Syria, and you've written about this, Stephen, it was a great, or I saw your interview on Press TV there, it was a brilliant interview where you said that MI6 and the CIA were orchestrating the so-called rebels in Syria, carrying out atrocities and car bombs and what have you. Now the Western media is full throttle covering Syria whenever it's actually the violence can be attributed to the actual Western government subversion. But when it comes to Bahrain, where actually innocent unarmed civilians are being slaughtered and horribly mutilated in the streets by the Al Khalifa regime and the Saudi backers, and which Washington and London are backing whole to the hilt with military supplies and etc. The Western media says absolutely nothing, or very, very little, you know, about Bahrain. Now, that to me, you know, if you really want to kind of measure the integrity of Western governments, if you have a doubt about it, and you want to really say, well, what is their commitment to human rights and international law and democratic principle? Well, look at Bahrain, because Bahrain really exposes the decrepit morality and the deception of Western governments and their complete cynicism with regard to Syria and Libya.
Oh, there's no question about it, Finian. Absolutely no question about it. But, you know, you can point to so many other places in the world, especially hot spots, and the way the U.S. major media report on it, especially on television. It's bad in print, but television is just an abomination. And it doesn't matter whether it's Fox or CBS or NBC. They give you the broadcast channels. They'll give you 30 minutes a day. Then they have their miscellaneous programs that are so light that they simply don't get in depth into anything of any significance. Even if they cover a major issue, it's done with a light touch that's absolutely worthless, even if they told the truth. I mean, these are tough issues that need serious, detailed discussion, and you'll never get it.
I noticed, Stephen, I mean, I try not to watch the mainstream media too much because it's so sickening and frustrating. I mean, I would watch Press TV, you know, the Iranian channel. I enjoy that. I think it's a pretty good, pretty good news channel. Like they're telling as it's happening, pretty much. But the likes of the BBC and CNN, I mean, what gets me is just this repetitive mantra about Syria that, you know, they imply or insinuate that the government forces are carrying out massacres without any supporting evidence or you know smoking gun. I mean, it's always, you know, their claims are always attributed to according to opposition groups. You know, this is a repeated mantra, according to opposition groups. Well, where's the verification of these claims, and where's the hard evidence? I mean, I know it's restricted for journalists to go into Syria, but there's a kind of an abiding... Sorry, Stephen, are we over the time there?
I'm here, Finian. That music means we need to take a break. Do this. Hold that.
Yeah.
Hold your thought, and we'll come right back to it as soon as we come back.
Okay, Stephen. Sure.
We will be right back. Well, I hope I'm still connected. I lost the audio. Finian, can you hear me?
Yes, Stephen, you just as good as ever.
Oh,
can you hear you loud and clear, Stephen?
That's all that counts. The band in the background can go along its merry way. It's you and I that count, Finian. Let me let you pick up where you left off.
Yeah, I just, sorry, Stephen, to hope I'm coming across coherently, but I mean, my kind of impression from the way the Western media is covering Syria in particular, let's just talk about Syria here, it's just like, it's very obviously an agenda. I mean, there's massacres happening, or allegedly happening, reported to be happening, but whereas there's no, very little investigation or verification of claims, and there's the Western mainstream media, you know, whether it's the Financial Times or the BBC or the British Independent or CNN, there's this really telling over-reliance on anonymous opposition sources for their information. It's always like another massacre happened today in Hama province, for example, according to opposition sources. I mean, you know, it's always like a headline, a continual headline mantra with the implication or insinuation that the Assad government forces are carrying out these massacres. But there's no verification or independent verification of these claims. And you know, why is there this kind of like, very obvious, very noticeable reliance on one source of your information, i.e. so-called opposition sources. And, I mean, you made the point on Press TV recently, Stephen, and that MI6 and the CIA are up to their necks in directing traffic here, the traffic of terrorism and... military subversion in Syria, and the Saudis are and the Qataris and the Bahrainis, the Persian Gulf states, Persian Arab Gulf states, are supplying the funds, didn't they? They pledged $100 million on the 1st of April this year at the so-called Friends of Syria conference in Istanbul, and so there's a huge war chest there. The Americans and the British are directing the the munitions, and there's no doubt the strategies of how to carry out dirty war, and they're the masters at that, given their track record in this country of Northern Ireland, and also Iraq and Vietnam and El Salvador and you name it. So it's very plausible that these so-called atrocities and massacres are probably being carried out by agents, proxies of the West to create this agenda to then justify some kind of intervention, military overt intervention in Syria under a NATO flag, and the Western media are facilitating that agenda. It's a repeat of Libya. It's almost like a repeat of Libya. And I noticed there today too, Stephen. I don't know if you got this report, but in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, they were using an Associated Press feed, but the report in it is that Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, has accused Iran of colluding with Syria in carrying out these massacres. Now, I mean, I'm sorry to laugh a wee bit, but it's just becomes ridiculously transparent that the agenda is to not only take down Assad, a government that the West do not like, because he's a thorn in their geopolitical backside in that part of the world, and his ally Iran, that's the next prize, the next goal for them. So this kind of conflating now Tehran with Syria over alleged atrocities allegedly carried out by Syrian forces, which will justify NATO intervention and Israeli intervention in Syria to overthrow a government. I mean, that's a war crime. That's what you call a war of aggression. But it'll be kind of done under the pretext of protecting human rights and upholding international law. The irony is that the violations are actually stemming, in my view, and according to reliable sources like Stephen Lindman and other people, the actual sources of the violence in Syria is the Western governments, creating the conditions which will then justify their further criminal intervention in Syria and eventually Iran, if they can pull that conflation off successfully, of conflating Iran with the Syrian government over alleged atrocities. And as I said, Stephen, what really is very telling in all this is, well, what about Bahrain? We're proportionate to the population, the number of people in Bahrain. You would have violence that would eclipse Syria. And yet the Western governments and their media are vacant on covering what's going on in Bahrain, even though Bahrain, in my view, represents a genuine uprising by the people against a despotic regime that you quite eloquently described, and yet the where is the help from the West? These organs of free speech and commitment to human rights. Where is their their brave help at this time when Bahrain is in an extreme hour of need? Where is the Western government? Nowhere. That exposes their complete bankruptcy in terms of morals and international law and foreign policy.
Well, there's no question about it, Finney. I hadn't checked Haaretz yet today, but I have the article I think you're referring to up on my desktop now, published today.
I invite you to read it, Stephen, and your listeners, because the headline is very dramatic, very provocative, very, very serious. But yet the whole article, Haaretz is taking it from Associated Press. They're the feed on it. It's not really Haaretz, but it's Associated Press. So you'll pick it up on other papers, no doubt, that feed off Associated Press. But there's no, unless I miss something, but there's no evidence to back up this very tendentious. Controversial.
That's absolutely right, Gideon. I mean, this is a furious. Iran is used to being charged with all kinds of offenses, you know, developing and building a nuclear arsenal, wanting to destroy Israel. It goes on and on, threatening its neighbors, the leading cause of terrorism in the world. That's an AIPAC charge. Other people pick it up. I mean, it's endless against Iran. When you want to demonize an individual or a country, Finian, you come up with all kinds of spurious accusations. And, you know, the old line, if you keep repeating something often enough, and if enough people hear it, they'll believe anything. They don't hear the other side.
Yeah, the big lie theory, you know. Yeah.
What's the line about, maybe Winston Churchill, I think, was attributed to saying this, that a big lie can get halfway around the world before you and I could get out of bed and put our socks on.
Yeah, good one, Stephen. And it's very apt, you know, and today when we look at these, you know, events in Syria and, but, you know, Iran, and it's very up to what there was, you know, the big lie theory and how the Western corporate media, you know, barrage that misinformation, and you know, it's very powerful. But I mean, luckily, with the growth in global communication, we've got now the alternative sources, global research, your radio this radio station, your own website, Stephen, your writings. I mean, it's you know, we might be outgunned in terms of finances and you know, airwaves and whatever, you know, print copy and but I mean, I think my analogy would be, you know, in a heap of coal, a diamond will shine all the more brightly and be more noticeable, and the diamond being the truth. And so we can have like a heap of blackness and you know, misinformation that constitutes like so-called news in the mainstream media. But you know, when the truth is told about whatever the story is, whether it's Iran or Syria or Bahrain, that truth stands out glaringly. And I think people recognize truth, you know, when it makes sense, when it's coherent, when it's substantiated, when it's you know, it describes the world more accurately that they're experiencing and they're frustrated with. And I think, you know, luckily, while the forces of misinformation have magnified tremendously over the years, and getting back to your memories of World War II propaganda, but equally, luckily, on the other side of the coin, we've got, you know, freer information, and hopefully it'll counteract the massive escalation of misinformation that is you know, occurred in the last few decades.
I don't have to explain to my listeners, it's like preaching to the choir. Anybody who listens to this program is well informed, because they also go to other alternative sources. You know, when I was back in school, there was no internet, there were no computers, there were none of the things that people have today. And I don't know whether it's a majority or whatever the percentage is of people just in America who are connected online. It's a huge percentage, whatever it is. And there's no excuse for people not finding what the most credible sources of information they can, and if they spend just a minimal amount of time every day, they literally can know what the heck is going on, or enough about it to realize when you turn on your TV set and you watch any of the television news programs, whether it's opinion, whether it's straight news broadcasting, the difference between what you get on alternative sources, and you still have to pick and choose, because some of them are not nearly as good as they claim they are, or want you to believe. You really want to find the best of the best. Global Research is certainly that, and there's Global Research TV, as well as the printed material online, this program for audio, the things that I write, but there are lots of good sources. And there are some that you can separate the wheat from the chaff very easily with a minimal effort. And I would say if everybody spent even just 30 minutes a day online, keeping up to date on what's important, they would know enough to realize they're being scammed, they're being harmed. It doesn't matter whether it's a Republican or a Democrat. They are all the same. They are all the same on the issues mattering most. I say it all the time, Finian. There's not a dime's worth of difference between an Obama or a George Bush or a Romney or any of them. They differ on some of the smaller issues, which are not small to the people affected, and they're certainly not small at all, but they don't rise to the level of war and peace or corporate empowerment or the great harm done to the vast majority of people, not just in America, but around the world. Those are the major issues that everybody can know enough about in 30 minutes or less a day to realize we're being harmed, and maybe that would inspire them to do something about it. And I say this all the time too, Finian, the only way in world history, there is no other way, the only way rightful change, progressive change, change for the better ever comes is when ordinary people at the grassroots decide they're not going to take it anymore, and they go out and they work for the change, and it never comes easily or quickly. It can take years. It can take longer than that. There's an I.F. Stone quote that I love. It's very long, and I don't remember it verbatim by any means, but it goes something like, the only battles worth fighting are the ones you know you're going to lose. Only one, the one you know you're going to lose, because if you fight them and you keep fighting them and others pick up the baton after you're gone and they fight them, then somewhere down the line, somebody is going to inherit that baton and they're going to win because of what you did way back when. And that's the way great battles are won. Slavery was ended. Labor got rights. Civil rights were won. It's all lost now because the energy waned and it's all lost, and the criminals are worse than ever. The harm is greater than ever. It obsesses me, Finian. It obsesses me in my senior years that I'm going down fighting on my feet, and I don't give a damn what these people think. I want to take them on any way I can.
Yeah, it's inspirational, Stephen, you know. And who was that quote from, Stephen, that you said there, that you referred to earlier?
The lie getting around the world?
Yeah.
The
only battles worth fighting are the ones that...
I.F. Stone.
Ah, yeah.
Oh, yeah,
right.
I wrote about him a couple of years ago.
Yeah, great.
I barely remember him. He died... Oh, I think close to 35 years ago now. And he, at one time, I mean, this was a great muckraking journalist. And way back, he showed up on programs like NBC's Meet the Press, premier Sunday discussion program on politics and related issues. And he actually showed up on it. And there was one time that got him banished when he made the case for universal health care. Universal health care on the air, and he was debating someone who had the opposite point of view. This was when Harry Truman was president, and what he said was absolutely on the mark, and he mentioned it himself, that after that broadcast, he never was invited back again.
Really? Yeah. Oh, man. You know. I must check that. I mean, of course I know of the name, but I must check him out, because he sounds like an interesting character indeed.
I've read a lot of his books. He wrote A Secret History of the Korean War, Finian, and I got a used copy I bought for $10, and guess what, to my absolute astonishment, I treasure this book not just because of the truths that he knew about before, there was a lot more that came out, but he revealed a lot of truths, but I got a book that he had signed personally.
Wow.
I was flabbergasted.
I'd love to read that, Stephen. You know, Mustin. Yeah.
I opened up the book, and there was, I mean, he really signed it. And and somebody sold that to a secondhand store for some reason. Can't imagine anybody wanted to do it. For $10, it was an absolute steal.
Really?
I would sell it for $100.
Well, what a windfall that was, huh? Yeah.
I've read a bunch of his books. They're all on my shelf. He did marvelous writing. If he were alive today, Finian, I would invite him on this program.
Oh, wow. That would be a treat, you know. But
can I mention one more thing about him? way back when Israel became a state in 1948, nobody knew what was to come, and nobody really knew the slaughter that took place then. At least people on the outside, they didn't know. There wasn't much reporting about it. And he thought it was a wonderful thing that the persecuted Jews finally had a state. Well, I think most outside observers would feel that way. And he traveled to Israel to see things firsthand. And later on, he discovered the truth, and he completely turned around. And I don't want to say he became jaded. He became upset that at the beginning he didn't know what the real Israel was all about. Mm-hmm. But then he discovered it, and he realized that what he said about it in writing, in his books, was absolutely wrong. And I think he completely reversed himself and said other more truthful things that he knew about. By the way, one other thing about Israel. You mentioned in Bahrain, a number of people beyond 15 or 20, whatever it is, cannot assemble publicly. It's illegal. Well, in occupied Palestine, Finian, Israel has a military order. They have hundreds of military orders. This is the way life is governed in occupied Palestine, because it's a military occupation. But one of the military orders is there cannot be a demonstration of over 10 people publicly without specific permission, which is impossible to get. Yeah. And if you do it, you're going to be attacked, you're going to be tear gassed, they're going to fire rubber bullets at you, they're going to arrest you, and they do it all the time.
Yeah, well, that's very similar to the situation in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia.
Oh,
you know,
absolutely.
And it's kind of a total misconception. You know, the Arab and Israel. There's some sort of conflict. I mean, these regimes are hand in glove with the Zionist regime. And what they're perpetrating on their own people is similar to the Zionist abuse of Palestinians, destroying medical centers and places of worship, mosques. I mean, those regimes, they might be Arab and Muslim in name, but I mean they're certainly not adhering to any kind of faith that could be described as such. You know, because they're treatment of their own people, the Shia people, is just heinous. You know, of course, there's a reason for that because of their Sunni faith, their extreme Sunnism or Wahhabism is very much an antipathy towards Shiism, and of course, the Shia being the majority will strengthen their privileged position. But just when you're mentioning Israel there, Stephen, it's very, very, very similar. You know, this ban on public gatherings, and it's terrible. I mean, it's really just, I was just gobsmacked when I read that in Haaretz today, that quote from Netanyahu. He was condemning Syria for allegedly slaughtering its people, and that there must be some international intervention here, and he actually referred to it as a crime against humanity, what was going on in Syria, and he was linking it to Tehran and what have you. But I mean, I just couldn't believe, here you've got a guy who's overseeing a military dictatorship occupation of Palestinian territory, injuring, killing children, innocent civilians, and yet he's pontificating about a spurious case of crimes against humanity in Syria, because the crimes are being whipped up and fueled and fomented by the West, the Netanyahu is allied to. So I mean, let's get that straight. But I mean, that aside, I mean, for him to be supposedly concerned about human rights and protecting human rights and international law and crimes against humanity in Syria, and yet you just pointed out there, what are they? They're doing the exact same and worse in Palestine. Stephen, how are we doing for time here, Steve?
I think we have about 2 minutes left.
I just want to end off quickly here, Stephen, with one thing. This week in Ireland, in Dublin, we've got this massive demonstration being planned for Bahrain, and it's being actually supported by the Palestinian Solidarity Group and various other people, the doctors, like Professor Owen O'Brien, Professor Damien McCormick, senior, respected, very respected, highly highly reputed doctors, and it's all in solidarity with Bahrain, and in particular the Bahraini medics who are being their case is being reviewed this week in Bahrain as to whether they're going to have to live out their sentences of up to 15 years or more. They've got an appeal going. It's an ongoing thing. But anyway, we're organising a demonstration, and hopefully there'll be a good turnout. We're assembling in Dublin, and we're marching from the Royal College of Surgeons of Ireland, which has a very disgraceful connection with the Bahraini regime that I exposed in an article last April for that was published in Global Research, and because the Royal College is up to its neck in property investments with the Bahraini regime, and so they've turned a blind eye to what was being perpetrated against their members and citizens. So we're marching from the Royal College of Surgeons in Dublin to the government buildings, and we're calling on the Irish Dublin government to take a much more vocal stance towards Bahrain.
Oh, it's a big issue, Finney. And if I were there, I'd be out there with you. I'm not a very good matcha because physically I just can't do it. But I would be there, maybe doing a little bit less than matching, but certainly being there and being there with you in spirit. And I wish we had more time to go on. But the music says I've got to wrap up the program. It was terrific having you back on.
It was a pleasure talking to you, Stephen, as always. And you're just such a great guy and lovely spirit, and thanks very much, Stephen, for your good wishes.
Phineas, thank you so much. I look forward to having you back again, and I know you'll be hitting the road again when I'm not sure, but you'll let me know and we'll stay in touch.
Yeah.
And I'll get you back on this program for more. You're a marvelous guest and I love having you on.
Oh, thanks a lot, Stephen. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday now. Have a great day there.
Thank you, Phineas. And I'll just remind my listeners, every Thursday, of course, join us 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends, Saturday and Sunday, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.